TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
The debate over the peaking of oil on the planet has begun. And for the scientists involved, it is not so much a question of if or how, but when.
You think Cheney was kidding when he said a war that won't end in our lifetimes? Do you think Cheney was kidding when he said this is going to be the biggest conflict that we've ever seen?
This is part two of an hour-long program on peak oil, recorded at the International Inquiry into 911 in San Francisco in March of 2004. Today you will hear from Mike Rupert, publisher of From the Wilderness, and formerly a police officer with the Los Angeles Police Department. Rupert makes an eloquent argument that the wars on Afghanistan and Iraq were planned long before 911, and that their main focus was on seizing the most important remaining supplies of oil. Since oil has begun to run out, Rupert says, access to the remaining productive oil fields and proven reserves becomes a matter of military priority. 911 was used, or maybe even arranged, to serve as a pretext of war for oil. Here's Mike Rupert.
The Bush administration has nothing left to run on except for its so-called success and leadership in the war on terror. Once the weapons of mass destruction were on the table exposed as lies, once the yellow cake uranium from Niger was on the table exposed as lies, once the imminent threat of Saddam Hussein was on the table exposed as a lie, then automatically 9/11 was on the table to be exposed as a lie. So, what we have to do in establishing in a court, in a trial, is you have to establish means, motive, and opportunity. And part of what I'm going to talk about today is the motive for 9/11. You've already seen some excellent material on what peak oil is and how it works. Now I'm going to tie that together with the fact that we know that the Bush administration was aware of it and seriously focused on it. This is just a summary of some of the stuff we've done at From the Wilderness since 9/11. I don't have to go into that. But many of you now are cheering and embracing Richard Clark for his denunciation of the Bush administration, but I got some news for you. Richard Clark is cementing the lies of 9/11 in place, and a lot of people are falling for it. So we have to be very careful about what we embrace here, especially in its totality. Richard Clark's position is, my God, I was warning the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. I wrote all these urgent memos that something had to be done about Al-Qaeda, about the Taliban, and as if no move had been made. Now, of course, we know that plans for the invasion of Afghanistan arrived on President Bush's desk just, I think it was 4 days before the attacks of 9/11. Well, those plans were not written in 4 days, obviously. As a matter of fact, the military preparations had been going on for several years. We had U.S. troops in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan. The Pakistani military was involved. It was being published in Russian newspapers, Izvestia, that a joint military invasion was already on the table. There was a book which came out right after 9/11 by Guillaume Dasquier and Brissard called Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. It has some good stuff, some bad stuff in it, but they document the negotiations of a group called 6+2 over pipelines and oil reserves in the Caspian Basin. But it was widely known that the U.S. was going to invade Afghanistan, so Richard Clark ain't telling you the truth. What else is he not telling you the truth about? He is enshrining the lies that need to be enshrined to keep a power structure greater than George W. Bush in power. This is from the BBC's George Arney. U.S. planned attack on Taliban. It was in place. He published this 18 September, but he documents that going back 6-8 months, a year, well back into the Clinton administration before the attacks, the U.S. military had a plan to invade Afghanistan. But now we come to a quote from the U.S. Energy Policy. This is the Vice President Cheney's National Energy Policy Development Group, which concluded its work in May of 2001 in absolute secrecy, and which has to this day, in spite of several lawsuits and a very vigorous campaign by Congressman Henry Waxman of California, has refused to reveal its records from public from hearings that were paid for out of public money involving outside businesses. It's going to be a Supreme Court ruling this July, and I have said consistently since 9/11, the deepest, darkest secrets of 9/11, the motive for 9/11, lies in Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force. Look at a couple of quotes. America in the year 2001 faces the most serious energy shortage since the oil embargoes of the 1970s. Estimates indicate that over the next 20 years, U.S. oil consumption will increase by 33%, natural gas consumption by well over 50%, and demand for electricity will rise by 45%. U.S. energy consumption is expected to increase by 32% by 2020. Between 2000 and 2020, U.S. natural gas demand is projected by the Energy Information Administration to increase by more than 50%. Yet we produce 39% less oil today than we did in 1970, the peak year of U.S. production, leaving us more reliant on foreign suppliers. On our present course, America 20 years from now will import nearly 2 of every 3 barrels of oil, a condition of increased dependency on foreign powers that do not always have America's best interests at heart, as if it was somehow their obligation to have our best interests at heart. Look, let's talk about peak oil quick, and I'm really tired of the debate. I'm really tired of there's no proof, there's no evidence. I'm not going to take time to go through this, but if we talk about peak oil real quickly, who's been talking about it? Foreign Affairs Magazine, James Kenneth Galbraith. This is the Sunday Morning Herald, The End of Oil, the Halifax Limited, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Now, there's a real group of conspiracy nuts. For immediate relief, oil shortages likely, this is Petroleum Review, they've done the math. The big oil shortages arrive in 2007. The Independent, Saudi Aramco, Nature, there's a real conspiracy rag. BBC News, The Los Angeles Times. I can do this for hours with the people who are talking about it. This is a story from ABC News, which talks about how serious, it says exactly what Richard Heinberg was just telling you. So as CNN said it, I can do the same thing with natural gas. So don't tell me it's not real. It's real. We've done the studies. We've done the analysis of the production numbers. The difference between natural gas and oil is that oil flows down a bell curve so that you have to expend more energy as you go off the cliff to get lower quality, lesser quality oil. The light sweet crude's at the top. We drain the big fields, but now we've got to go deep, pump in steam, pump in water to get sour oil. Every barrel of oil becomes not only harder to find, it becomes more expensive to produce. Natural gas, it just blows until there's no more pressure, and we go off a cliff. And we're off the cliff. I predicted successfully 6 weeks before it happened the blackout of last August 14th. How did I do that? Because I was watching natural gas numbers. They haven't built new infrastructure because there's no natural gas to power the plants. And I got a real nasty surprise for you Greens out there that's coming up. In his just released book, Out of Gas, this is from the Goodstein book, Goodstein argues forcefully that worldwide production of oil will peak soon, possibly within this decade. Clear evidence is showing that it peaked actually in 2000. As Saudi Arabia peaked. That would be followed by declining availability of fossil fuels that could plunge the world into global conflicts as nations struggle to capture their piece of a shrinking pie. I would ask you, does that bear any resemblance to the world we're living in today? Yeah. Now, the most important article I've written in the last 2 years is called In Your Face. It's a free story, and I used some work done by the brilliant Professor Michael Clare, who wrote a book called Resource Wars. He's a professor in New England, very widely recognized, where he dissected what was known out of the Energy Policy Task Force official report. And in his analysis, he said clearly what they're saying is there's only so much oil, and if we're going to need X number of barrels, we have to take it away from somebody else. That's the bottom line. He has a great quote here. The Cheney report is very guarded about the amount of foreign oil that will be required. The only clue provided by the public report is a chart of net U.S. oil consumption and production over time. According to this illustration, domestic oil field production will decline from about 8.5 million barrels per day in 2002 to 7 million barrels a day in 2020, while consumption will jump from 19.5 million to 25.5 million barrels a day. That suggests imports of other sources will have to rise from 11 million to 18.5 million barrels a day, most of the recommendations of the National Energy Policy Group are aimed at procuring the 7.5 million per day increment equivalent to the total consumption, total oil consumed by China and India. We are at a place where if we take it from somebody else, we are literally taking it from somebody else. And if you get nothing else out of what I say today, watch this map. 7 pages of records from the National Energy Policy Development Group were surfaced as a result of a FOIA, or Freedom of Information Act, suit filed by the Sierra Club. And some of those pages included maps. Now, this is not the map. I had people in my office take the maps, which are cut up. They're like a mosaic. And I had them assemble the oil field maps into what you see on the left of the screen. This is what they were talking about in Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force, along with lists of who had development contracts that literally boil down to, if we invade, who can we get to go along with us to form a coalition of the willing if we offer them a piece of the pie, and who absolutely cannot afford to endorse a U.S. invasion of the region. And that's exactly the way it played out. In other words, what they were discussing in May was a mirror of what happened after the Iraqi invasion. But here's a secret, and it's very chilling. This area right here is what was disclosed from the maps out of the National Energy Policy Development Group. If you were to take this triangle from way up here just north of Mosul, run through this part of Iran down here, and just expand it to there, down here, you have just circled 60% of all the recoverable oil on planet Earth. 60% of all the oil is in an area that fits easily into Texas. 6 out of every 10 barrels left remaining for this planet is there, but it takes 6 weeks to get a drop of oil from that region into an American gas tank. This is a map I did more than 2 years ago, before we invaded Iraq. But Iraq is now invaded. Now, if you look at the military deployment around the region, and you go back and look at that map again, don't you see what we've done? We have absolutely encircled the oil. And that was the plan. That was the plan from December 11th. It is the plan that has been executed. Now, I have said clearly also that China is the end game from oil. I wrote this in From the Wilderness, my newsletter, probably about 18 to 20 months ago. This is a story from February of this year from the LA Times. What does it say? China just passed Japan as the second largest oil importing nation on the planet. And they're consumption is exploding. Chinese auto sales went up 100% in 1 year. And the rub is that Wall Street's financial markets will die if there is no market in China to buy computers, automobiles, factories, to take our jobs, to sell to the Chinese people. So we can't live with them and we can't live without them. But that's the end game. And it's becoming extremely clear, especially as China starts increasing military aid to West African nations. Look at this. And the scariest story we've ever published on From the Wilderness is called Eating Fossil Fuels. And I encourage you to read it. It was a subscriber-only story. We've just made it free. My subscribers had it 8 months ago. The world consumes 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food that we eat. You take away the hydrocarbon energy, you take away the food. All fertilizers are made from natural gas. All pesticides are made from petroleum. All food crops are irrigated by electricity generated by burning natural gas or oil or coal. Some cases, atomic power. Some cases, small cases, hydroelectric. But China is already reaching a food crisis, and CNN's Lou Dobbs just a few months ago reported that the breadbasket of the world, the U.S. and Canada, will soon no longer be able to export grain. Why? Because our topsoil has become so eroded, it is like a sponge onto which we pour chemicals to grow food, and we ain't going to be able to feed the world anymore. Now, how do you think the world's going to feel about it if we're stealing all their natural resources and we're not even sending out grain anymore? This is probably one of my early on great achievements. This is a map I produced from Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, published in 1997. And the broader circle, the outside one, from a map in 1997, was where Brzezinski said the next world conflict was going to occur. When I worked for LAPD, we called that a clue. So It's a map we prepared it from the wilderness going to West Africa since 9/11. Every place you see a fire is a place where there has been an outbreak of terrorist or subversive activity. Everywhere you see an oil well, there's new oil development. Everywhere you see a green soldier is a place where U.S. Army Special Forces have been deployed since 9/11. Is that suspicious to you? Now, Africa is a drop in the bucket compared to, in terms of reserve numbers, compared to the Middle East. But the difference is this. It takes 6 weeks to get a drop of oil from the Persian Gulf into your gas tank. It takes 2 weeks to get a drop of oil from Nigeria into your gas tank. And isn't it strange that all the focus after the Spanish bombings is now moving toward Morocco? Duh. Right here, Morocco, on the up on the upper west coast of Africa, where Kerr McGee, Halliburton, and oil companies have just secured major new leases for smaller fields to develop. Terrorism goes exactly where the oil is. That's the map I've been following for 2 years, and it's why I've been able to be so far ahead. I'm just following the oil. London Times, America keen to exploit boom in Africa's black gold. Voices of America, there's a fine nonpartisan outfit funded by the CIA. But look at a story that they produced here last May of 2003. U.S. NATO allies may focus on Africa, predicts NATO senior military commander General James Jones, with that goofy look on his face there, has announced that NATO is shifting its focus to West Africa. That's right before the U.S. Navy gave Nigeria 6 U.S. warships. So I was writing a year and a half ago, hey, we're going to West Africa to fight. And now we come to Haiti. Here's a map. See, Haiti's up there on the left of the island of Hispaniola right there. That's Florida up there. You see, look at the fact that Haiti is an exact midpoint between the southern coast of Florida and Venezuela. We can't invade Venezuela unless we control the whole island. Yeah, we have military bases in Puerto Rico, some in the Dominican Republic, but the U.S. would never engage in a military occupation with an indigenous Latin American or French population that's hostile to U.S. interests next to Cuba behind the supply lines to invade Venezuela. That is why immediately after we had the coup d'etat in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez said, hey, baby, Chavez is not Aristide and Venezuela is not Haiti. If Bush, he called Bush an asshole, as quoted by Reuters. And Hugo Chavez, El Zorro, as they call him, said, if America makes one move to Venezuela, I'll shut off their oil immediately. Now, you take that oil away from the United States, and the U.S. economy collapses. There's no elasticity. It's not a matter of how much oil you take out. It's the fact that if you take out, you know, an ounce out of a system that's already at capacity, the whole system collapses. Just a few days ago before I came up, there was a story from the Venezuelan Times how the Chinese government was in Venezuela negotiating to buy all of Venezuela's oil. Now, if I really want to offend you, I came back from the Peak Oil Conference, the second Peak Oil Conference in Paris last May. And I had reported out of that, number one, that Saudi Arabian reserves had probably peaked. I spoke with Ali Samsam Bakhtiari, who was the vice president of the Iranian National Oil Company. By the way, Iran peaked in 1987. You know that Iran is importing gasoline now? And I reported that he had said that Saudi reserves had peaked several months before the New York Times reported it just about a month ago or less than a month. I said that Matthew Simmons, the world's largest energy investment banker, had suggested that Saudi Arabia had peaked. But I came back from Paris and I said, and we said, and I wasn't the only one to conclude this, that America's knee-jerk reaction in the face of peak oil would be two things. It would be to revert to coal and nuclear. Now, nobody even knows this. And I'm running through the Christian Science Monitor the other day and I see this story. This is a story from February 26, not too long ago. And it says right here that the United States has now started construction of 93 new coal-fired power plants. Coal. You know, the stuff, greenhouse gas, the stuff that kills us, the stuff that does global warming. And in Paris, we had this dialogue with a very nice guy from the Global Commons Institute, who was a very big green activist, and he had admitted that peak oil would probably kill us before greenhouse gases do. And then we both said, unless the United States reverts to coal. which is the only energy we can get. It's so under the radar. Kyoto, we never signed anyway. All the environmental laws are out. 93 new coal-fired plants pumping carbon dioxide directly into the atmosphere. And they're already being built. Why? Dick Cheney told you. The American way of life is not negotiable. And we will commit suicide. We will commit global human suicide, the way species commit suicide as a result of over-adaptation, because we will not negotiate our standards of consumption. James Kenneth Galbraith, and I'm going to read these quotes, and they're very important. Maybe I should just cut off there. James Kenneth Galbraith, you know, is the son of John Galbraith, an incredible economist. Let me read you what he wrote in November of 2002. The real economic cost of Bush's empire building is twofold. It diverts attention from pressing economic problems at home, and it sets the United States on a long-term imperial path that is economically ruinous. Nor is Bush's strategy necessarily irrational insofar as it affects oil in the short run. With a new Iraqi government, the United States will gain a client state that is prepared to help keep the oil price within the band that both the U.S. consumers and the remaining U.S. oil producers can tolerate. Notice he said remaining. They're dropping out. There's no more oil. Low enough so as not to fatally drain purchasing power from the former, high enough so as not to immediately ruin the latter. Given the George W. Bush, Dick Cheney commitment to unlimited oil consumption, this will prove useful in putting off a day of reckoning. As total world oil production declines, credible scientific evidence suggests that this may start happening quite soon, the Middle East's share of the remaining reserves will rise. So too would the potential for cartel control and price manipulation. A robust U.S. military presence in the oil fields, directly or by proxy, will naturally make higher oil prices less of a danger. This is part of the appeal of the war with Iraq. First, private business investment in the United States has fallen virtually to the capital replacement level. That's called life support when you're speaking economically. Second, the recession in consumer spending cannot be put off forever. American households are still being crushed by debt. Third, state and local government budgets continue to implode. Reasonable estimates now show $50 billion in deficits at the state level, and the losses are surely almost as large at the local level. Fourth, we have economic effects of the decline of our financial markets, which have already lost more than $8 trillion in nominal shareholder value since their peak in 2000. To some extent, these losses are due to the corruption of certain major corporations, including several, not least Halliburton, that are closely tied to the military petroleum complex. It is a straightforward fact that if global oil production starts to decline, but U.S. consumption does not, everyone else will be required to cut purchases and uses of oil. But how can oil prices be held stable for Americans, yet made to rise for everybody else? Only by a policy of continuing depreciation in everyone else's currency. Such a policy of dollar hegemony and amid worldwide financial instability, of crushing debt burdens and deflation throughout the developing world, is perverse. Meanwhile, we will not experience even a gradual exposure, as Richard was talking about, as I have written about extensively at From the Wilderness. We've published many stories on alternative energy. We'll not experience even a gradual exposure to the changing energy balance. We will therefore never make the investments required to adjust, even eventually, to a world of scarce and expensive oil. In the end, therefore, that world will arrive much more abruptly than it otherwise would, shaking the fragile edifice of our oil economy to its foundations, and we will someday face a double explosion of anger against our arrogance and of actual shortage and collapsing living standards when the confidence of investors in the dollar finally gives way. That is a recipe for disaster. That is the recipe that we are following on this roadmap. My job with 9/11, of course, is to describe to you the plane crash, the train wreck, the disaster, the Holocaust, the Armageddon that just occurred. But while everybody's focusing over the carcass of 9/11, somebody's got to look up and say, there's another one coming. And it's here. It's here now. M. King Hubbard, who was the first pioneer to tell us about peak oil, who has been vindicated and validated so many times over the years, wrote so succinctly in his first book. He said, until you change the way money works, you will change nothing. In Paris, this is where my dear friend Catherine Austin Fitz comes in, a senior mega powerful Dutch economist came up and took the podium at the peak oil conference at the L'Institut du Pétrole Français, the French Institute of Petroleum, and said with all seriousness, it may not be profitable to slow the effects of decline. In English, that means is they can find no way of making money by saving human life and averting famine, disaster, war, and Armageddon. And if they can't find a way to make money, they won't do it. That's the world we live in. These are the choices we have to face. So as we play this game of 9/11, we must truly understand what the stakes are that we are facing, not as a country, not as anything else but a species, a species. To quote Colin Campbell, my good friend who founded, the species of Homo sapiens may not become extinct, although it may, but the subspecies of petroleum man most certainly will. Now, the question is, do we want to do it nice or do we want to do it nasty? The world has chosen to embark on a path that is the worst Nazi nightmare ever seen. It will be bloody, it will be violent, it will involve population reduction by the most brutal, venal, underhanded methods. So ultimately, what I have to say to you is that as I look at this and as I've studied this and as I've worked 26 years to unravel this covert mechanism that governs our lives, I'm firmly convinced that what we are now faced with is a choice offered to us by our Creator. Either evolve or perish. Thank you.
That was Mike Rupert, publisher of From the Wilderness. His upcoming book is called Truth and Lies of 9/11. Check out his website at fromthewilderness.com. You can find more information on Michael Rupert and Peak Oil on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of this program on Peak Oil with Richard Heinberg and Michael Rupert by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.